tube that clanked and bonked, though she knew it must have been one of the first things that happened. It was the way the doctor searched for dark trouble. There must have been a conversation, too, where a doctor explained the mass they'd found in her head. The mass was pressing on a critical part of Dot's brain. They would have to operate immediately. Dot would likely survive, the doctor told Dot's mother, but the post-op recovery could be very hard on a child, so they had to be ready for that. The next thing Dot remembered, she was waking up on a little bed with curtains pulled tightly around it. The air was cold, and she was alone. Her head was wrapped in bandages. Her body felt too heavy, like she'd gained 100 pounds. Outside the curtain, she heard beeps. Someone was gagging. Her last memory had been going to sleep in her bed. She'd had a dream about Wednesday Adams, whom she idolized. Sometimes she wrote Wednesday Adams on the line for her name on tests. But where was she now? She stared in horror at a needle taped to the back of her hand. It fed into a tube, which led to a bag on a post. She wanted to pull the needle out, but something told her not to, that it would hurt even worse. A figure parted the curtain. "Mommy?" Dot cried. It was a nurse in bear print scrubs. "Your mother will be back," she said. Tears spilled down Dot's cheeks. She felt scared. Why wasn't her mother here? A few minutes later, the curtain to her little bed parted, and Dorothy burst through. She wore a beautiful silk-wrapped dress, but the ties of its belt trailed behind her, unfastened. A slash of lipstick sloppily decorated her mouth. Her Chanel purse bumped against her hip, its clasp undone. She reached toward Dot and pulled her to her chest. Dot smelled her Dorothy scent, orange blossoms and Indian bunch grass. "My girl," she said, cradling Dot's head close. "My sweet, sweet girl. I'm here now." Dot nuzzled her nose against the soft, smooth skin of Dorothy's neck. Her aunt's pulse was so calm. Usually it chugged swiftly and industriously, like a giant 19th century machine. She stroked Dot's hair. "We're going to beat this. I'll be here, always. I'll help." And she was. And she did. Eliza. Blinded by the sun, I am granted a few blissful seconds of imagining, daydreaming, what Desmond Wells must look like. Rugged, wavy hair, olive skin, and squinty eyes with baked-in crow's feet. A rough-looking sort of fellow. The human version of a pickup truck, but sensitive, too. The kind of man who shyly brags about the yield from the fig tree in his backyard. Big hands, big muscles, a man who was strong enough to pick up a girl and spin her around on his pinky. Not normally the type of guy I go for, but definitely the sort of person fit to pull me out of a pool. Then he steps out of the direct sun. "Eliza," he says in a tenor tone. "Hello." He's no taller than I am, with thick black hair that's cut in a page boy at his chin. His eyebrows are woolly, and his nose ends at a comical point. There is something oily about his complexion, and he has a puzzling configuration of facial hair on his upper lip and chin. He looks like Guy Fawkes. He's wearing an Oxford shirt and a tapestry vest. His shoes are very shiny and narrow. His arms look thin. I can't imagine this person skimming a pool for bugs, let alone pulling a person from it. My shoulders droop. It isn't fair to be disappointed. Maybe I should have suspected this sort of person, since the text message response I'd gotten from him included a Game of Thrones-themed gif. Hi, I say tentatively. Thanks for coming. Another awkward pause. I can feel him looking at me. I feel grimy and puffy from my hospital stay, and the Lakers shirt reeks of sweat. Anyway, I say, leading him toward the back of the house. I'm not sure I want to let him inside. I'm funny about letting in people I don't know, especially people who look like this guy. Let's talk in the back. The backyard has a natural water stream and a guest house so small I can barely fit a bed. There's also a shed out back that can hold two horses. When I moved in, I heard a cacophony of whinnies and the air smelled like manure. Who knew people in Burbank kept horses? I don't have any, but there is one mare down the road that I like to visit. Beauty. She always pokes her nose out of her stall when she hears me coming, as if she knows my scent. Her eyes are so dark and limitless. She seems like she could keep a secret. There are times when I press my face to her muzzle and just stand there for a few moments, hoping no one will come around the bend and catch us. The patio has a lot of dead plants and a non-working fountain that's full of sticks and seed pods. I grab an empty Zivietz Porter beer bottle that was resting atop one of the lounge chairs and throw it into a spongy bush. Desmond narrows his eyes at the miniature carousel wedged between the guest house and the wall. I found it on eBay. It's a replica of an Alan Herschel from the 1950s, except it's got psychotic zebras, a pissed-off-looking swan, and a lion without a head. "That's quite a piece," he says with what seems like true admiration. "Thanks. It works if you want to ride on it." The song it plays sounds like Inagata De Vita. His chuckle is a half-avuncular, half-creepy, His gaze drifts to the papier-mâché rat sculpture I'd bought at a flea market. The rainbow rodent is smoking a joint and giving the finger. "Same to you, my friend," he says to it, elaborately bowing. I try not to grimace. "So," I say impatiently, "thanks for coming." I offer my hand to shake. His hand is calloused, and his grip is stronger than I expect. "Charmed," he says, holding my gaze. "I feel like I already know you." "Well, you pulled me out of the water, so I guess you sort of do." There's a flicker of something across his face. "Actually, m'lady, that's not what I mean." My eyes narrow on the paisley brocade on his vest. He's got an amulet around his neck that looks like the same ones this shaman I once visited in the desert, post-tumor, was selling in his gift shop. There is a crawling feeling up my spine, and I recall the residual sense of fear I experienced just before dropping into the water at the Tranquility. Maybe it was a bad idea to invite him here. I glance around the high walls that surround my house from everyone else's. It's hard to know if anyone is home in this neighborhood. The houses are smashed together, but they're eerily quiet and sequestered. Explain? I ask, trying not to let my voice shake. He looks sheepish. "I happen to know you're an author. I even requested a copy of your book." For a moment, I'm not sure what to say. "The dots?" I bleat, finally. He nods. How did you know I wrote that?"
"Forgive me, but after they took you away in the ambulance, I Googled you. I thought it would be important to know about the person whose life I just saved. And I read a press release about your book. It seemed right up my alley, so I requested a copy through the Amazon Vine program."
It strikes me as odd that a man like this thought my book would be right up his alley. Then again, I have no idea who my ideal reader is, except myself.
"But I didn't receive it." Desmond sounds disappointed. "Amazon said it wasn't available until publication."
"Yeah, we didn't end up going with the Vine promotion." I pick at a loose splinter on the table. "But how did you know my name at all? Did the cops read it off my ID or something?"
"You told me it. After I pulled you out. You were lucid, talking. Once I got you breathing again, that is."
My cheeks burn. I'd forgotten about receiving mouth to mouth. I imagine Desmond's bristly facial hair scraping against my skin. On instinct, my skin starts to feel rashy. "I don't remember that at all. What did I say exactly?"
Just your name, and something about a murder taking place at the resort in the 60s. And then your eyes got very big, and you said, "It is I." I wrinkle my nose. Huh. That sounds like something Gloria Swanson would say in Sunset Boulevard as she swirled into the ballroom in all her jewels. I used to watch that movie at least once a month. Anyway, after that, the paramedics showed up. My companion had called 911. Your companion? I picture an older, moneyed fellow leading this guy around on a studded leash. Paul, a work friend. I did all the rescuing, though. He smiles. So, how did you come up with your book idea? I find authors so intriguing. I'm hoping I might write a book someday. I'm not sure I'd call myself an author, per se. His face falls. Why not? Because I've only written one book, and it's not even out. He smiles at this, like I've told a joke. Oh, I'm sure you'll write others. I don't know about that. And I have no idea how we've gotten so off topic. I clear my throat. So, on Saturday, you and your companion just happened to be strolling by the pool area when I fell in, or... That's right. I was showing Paul around the grounds. It's a beautiful resort, isn't it? But then we heard thunder and started inside. We cut through next to the pool area, and that's when I heard the splash. I looked over the fence and saw there were no lifeguards. Then I noticed that whoever had jumped in wasn't coming up for air. He said this boastfully, as though this is Sherlock Holmes-level sleuthing. So you jumped in and fished me out? I asked. Exactly. He smiles proudly. I didn't waste a moment. You were easy to pull to the surface. So light. Like a hollow piece of wood. I'm not sure I've ever been compared to a piece of wood before. But there was no one else in the pool area. I believe everyone had been told to leave. Paul had to run for help. By the time a guard came, I'd already revived you. His eyes shine. Do you remember? I already told you. I don't remember anything. Ah, Desmond nods. So, I suppose you want to know about me, then. Your dashing rescuer who brought you back to life? I blink. Maybe this is why normal people invite their rescuers over. To thank them. To stroke their egos. To promise them their firstborn. Or to find out what their rescuers are like, so they can tell said firstborn. I want to laugh, but I don't want to wound Desmond's pride. He might leave. But before I can say anything, Desmond goes, Oh, now don't be shy. Let's see. My middle name is Lawrence. I was born in December, a Capricorn. I drink a lot of absinthe. The real kind, not the tripe they sell here in the States. I have a dealer in Nice. He leans back. Have you ever tried it? The only true way to drink it is the way the artistes did in Paris, poured over a sugar cube on a spoon. Sounds gross, I say absently, because I fear any enthusiasm might usher in an invitation to an absinthe drinking event. Desmond looks wounded. It's not gross. It's transcendent. I got into it during my side job. I'm the lead Caesar in the Circus Maximus in San Fernando. The what? The Circus Maximus in the Valley, the celebration of ancient Roman and Greek culture. Among other things, we do a reenactment of the Pompeii volcano disaster and all five acts of Julius Caesar. It's quite well attended. I must be looking at him with confusion because he adds, I can't believe you haven't heard of the Circus Maximus. I thought I read you were an English major. I wonder what else he's read about me. What does being an English major have to do with knowing about a Renaissance fair in the Valley? He harumphs. It is not a Renaissance fair. You should check it out. For 2 weeks in July, there are gladiator events, a soothsayer, a replication of the oracle at Delphi, a reenactment of Homer's Odyssey. That's from a completely different time period. He frowns. Well, sure. But we take some creative liberties. And you're Caesar, huh? I can so picture him in a toga and with a laurel in his hair. You like it? He juts up his nose. It's intense. I get assassinated 20 times in the 2-week period. I try to really get into the character, which means every time I go down, it really and truly feels like a death. He looks at me meaningfully, and for a moment, a very, very brief one, I'm a little bit curious. I wonder if he could possibly think about death as much as I do. I wonder if he likes reading suicide notes as much as I do. But then I fear I've let my gaze linger on him too long, and I avert my eyes. So, what brought you to the Tranquility again? Well, I'm a bit of a celebrity, too, Desmond says loftily. Besides being Caesar, I mean. I'm also the second in command of marketing for the Los Angeles Comic-Con. I was meeting with my team to strategize for this year's event. We came up with very important initiatives, like how we're going to have members of the Umbrella Corps from Resident Evil protect the female cosplayers in case anyone harasses them. Those umbrella people mean business. I have no idea what he's talking about. I also want to laugh, but I think he's actually serious. I can picture the poster in Tranquility's lobby, Comic-Con's logo, and then instructions directing the attendees to one of the conference rooms on the second floor. So, basically, your whole life is about conventions. His eyes dance. I love conventions. Hopefully, in the future, there will be conventions for everything you're into. People with the same interests could gather together and unite in their shared devotion to old-timey medicine balls, for instance, or clock-making. Or squirrels. Isn't that what social media is for? He sighs. It saddens me how social media has changed the way we interact with one another. So you don't have an Instagram account then? No Facebook for the convention? Well, yes, of course I do. But that's different. That's useful. You didn't by any chance retire to the Shipstead bar after your strategizing? I ask. Deciding to change the subject again, hoping we've done enough getting to know you bullshit. He fiddles with the hair on his chin. I don't know the name of the place we went to. What's it look like? They're going for a yacht club feel, but it's more like a downmarket cruise ship. Nope, we were in the one that looked like Easter Island. I sigh. I was hoping you could fill in a few blanks for me. Apparently, I was at the Shipstead that night. But I thought you didn't drink. I don't. Normally. My brain catches. How did you know I didn't drink? There's a small flicker across his lips, practically concealed under his curly mustache. I think you told me. You were saying all kinds of things when you regained consciousness. Then he leans in. So you can't remember. Anything? I shake my head. That sounds like what happened to our best chariot driver. He got trampled, had a concussion, and he forgot not only what happened that day, but the whole 2 weeks of the Ludi Circenses. He never got any of it back, poor man. Desmond looks mournful. I want to roll my eyes. I have a feeling the Circus Maximus is like what I've heard about athletes in the Olympic Village. They're crammed together in close quarters, dressed in questionable clothing, and they're all so excited about the pomp and circumstance that they celebrate by having lots and lots of sex. Except that in the Olympic Village, everyone is a hot Olympic athlete. And at the Circus Maximus, most people have day jobs at Best Buy. Still, I appreciate Desmond's acceptance of my botched memory. He's the first person I've come into contact with who isn't looking at me in this pool situation like it's all my doing. Well, I'm glad you were able to rescue me, I say. I'm glad too. His eyes sparkle. It's not every day someone like you falls into the bottom of a pool. I didn't mean to fall into that pool, you know, I blurt, before I can help myself. I am aware, he says without missing a beat. But then he cocks his head and looks at me strangely. Come again? There is a swoop in my stomach, but I decide to tell him. Guzman seems like he's a lot of things, but I doubt he'll judge. I didn't jump in, and I didn't accidentally fall in either. Desmond's brow furrows. An expression slides across his face I can't quite discern. Alarm, perhaps. A sudden bolt to the brain. So, then you... He trails off. His Adam's apple bobs. My heart lurches. I think someone pushed me. Do you know anything about that? He glances over his shoulder. I don't. I'm not sure. It could have been nothing. Please. I step closer to him, the closest I've been to him all day. He smells like a greenhouse, moss and algae. Tell me what you know. He glances behind him again. The silence seems to close in on us. The sun breaks from behind a cloud, slanting at us sideways, searing the part in my hair. Desmond's tongue darts from his mouth, pink and minnow-like. I think I saw someone running away. From the Dots. Even after Dot's brain tumor was removed, and she underwent radiation, her seizures still came weekly. The scariest were when she was at home, away from medical equipment and knowledgeable hands. Dorothy was always present and ready, her arms outstretched to catch Dot's falls. On their way to the hospital, Dorothy called Dot's mother. One time, she put her on speakerphone. Wait, she had another one? Dot's mother's voice squawked through the car. What the fuck is going on here? Dorothy pressed her lips together and quickly disabled the speaker function. When she was done with the call, she glanced at Dot in the back seat. I'm sure your mother didn't mean anything by that. She's just worried. But Dot felt alarmed. She'd never heard her mother use the word fuck, and certainly not in relation to her. Her aunt spirited Dot to the hospital, though she chose a different one to bring her to than the place where Dot had had her brain surgery. St. Mother Maria's, located west of the city. It's the best of the best, she told Dot. Dorothy had an encyclopedic knowledge on the best of the best. She knew the best place to get a shoe shine, your spine adjusted, or the perfect banana split. She knew the best restaurants to pick up a fireman or a studio executive. She knew the best ways to fake a car accident, if, perchance, you were in the mood for defrauding your insurance company. She knew the best place to buy greeting cards for very specific occasions. Sympathy for botched surgeries. Congratulations on your sixth marriage. And where to get false eyelashes stitched into your biological lashes. She knew the best place to clean an upholstered couch covered in blood. Not that I've ever had to use their services, but it's a good resource to have handy, she said. Dot's mother didn't even know the best place in their neighborhood to get pizza. Dr. Coder, who was assigned Dot's case, came into Dot's hospital room one day to talk about her condition. Look, we just can't pinpoint what could be causing these seizures. We'd like to keep her here in the hospital until we can figure it out. Dot's mother, who was sitting on the bed next to Dot's feet, bristled. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it her brain tumor that's causing the seizures? Typically, with surgery and radiation, these types of tumors are completely obliterated, and usually patients are symptom-free. Dot has already gone through those steps, so we're thinking something else might be at play. Dot's mother scratched a non-existent stain on her scrubs. I just don't understand how it could be something else. I just don't understand how this keeps happening. Dorothy touched her arm. There's no need to get worked up. Dot's mother glanced at her. This has been going on for too long. It's the 21st century. Medicine should be more advanced than this. It would be a much less complicated life if your little girl weren't sick, wouldn't it? Dorothy simpered. Dot's mother gave her a furious look. Dot didn't understand. Dr. Coder coughed. There are lots of avenues to try. We need to make sure it isn't an environmental issue, for example.
An environmental issue?
Dot's mother repeated.
Are you suggesting our house is full of poison?
Of course not. Dr. Coder stared down at Dot's file in her hands. A metallic noise clanged in the hall.
I understand your frustration, but we are doing all we can. I promise. We'll get to the bottom of it.
Dorothy gave the doctor a sympathetic smile.
Of course you will.
Her voice was like warm maple syrup. While Dot was in the hospital, Dorothy rented a hotel room at the Sheraton down the street. She could have gone back to her suite at the Magnolia in Beverly Hills, where she'd been living ever since Dot could remember, but Dorothy said she liked to be close, in case anything happened. She even bought a beeper and made the doctors page her before making any decisions. Dot appreciated her aunt's dedication and perseverance. Only once did Dot ask her if she needed to work on her novel, Riders of Caraway, instead of spending so much time by her side.
Pshaw, work, Dorothy scoffed. It can wait.
Meanwhile, Dot's mother went back to the dentist's office. She even resumed her regular full-time hours.
I need to keep my job so we keep our insurance, she explained.
But it hurt all the same. Dot winced when she saw her mother walk into the room in the morning in her balloon-printed scrubs, knowing that soon she'd be gone. Sometimes, it seemed as though she left the hospital with a skip in her step. Once, when her mother was in the bathroom, Dorothy rooted through her purse and unearthed an envelope of freshly printed photos. By the looks of it, her mother had taken pictures of a birthday party at the dentist's office.
Oh, look, they're having chocolate cake.
Dorothy slapped a rectangular image across Dot's legs.
And that's quite a smile your mother's got on her face, isn't it? Nice to see someone happy, anyway.
Dot decided to try her hardest not to need her mother. She turned away from her kisses and didn't answer her questions.
Oh, you shouldn't be so hard on her, Dorothy said.
But then, not half a beat later,
of course, you'll always have me.
That was right, Dot thought. Dorothy was more than enough. There was a rotating cast of nurses, aides, doctors, and specialists in to see Dot, eager to figure out why her brain kept locking up. She had CAT scans, PET scans, bone density tests, blood plasma draws, a spinal tap. Dorothy lorded over every treatment, wanting to know about every aspect of Dot's care. What went into changing the sheets? Why they took her blood so often, the types of needles they used for Dot's IV, what sorts of medications they gave Dot when she had a seizure, and the nutritional value of the smoothie they always gave Dot for lunch. She learned so much that she could probably have performed many of the minor procedures herself. In fact, one day while dozing, Dot felt the blood pressure cuff wrap around her arm and opened her eyes to find her aunt taking her vitals.
They let you do this now?
She asked, chuckling.
Dorothy blinked.
Sorry?
It was a different voice, higher and less raspy. Dot looked again. The woman taking her blood pressure had dark hair and a finely boned face, just like Dorothy's. The only difference was that her eyes were green. Dot told her aunt about the lookalike, and not much later, Dorothy got the experience for herself. The woman, whose name was Stella, shuffled in to take Dot's blood pressure, not even noticing Dorothy in the chair, and Dorothy, for once, didn't make her presence known. When she left, Dorothy exhaled.
That was amazing. It was like I was in the presence of a paranormal event. I'd split in two.
She should play a lookalike of me at parties.
Or you could play a lookalike of her, Dot quipped. Dorothy wrinkled her nose.
Why would I do that?
The next time Stella came in, Dorothy invited her to sit on Dot's bed and chat. Stella was younger than Dorothy, and her nails were bitten to the quick. Dorothy moved close, lifted a lock of Stella's hair, and sniffed it.
Do you get ovarian cysts from time to time? She asked. Is your eyesight just a touch myopic?
Stella's eyes darted.
Pardon?
Dorothy looked at Dot.
I want to see if her insides are the same as mine, too.
Then she pressed her face close to Stella's.
Who's prettier?
By this time, a nurse had entered the room and was giving Dorothy a skeptical look. Dot surreptitiously pointed in her aunt's direction, not wanting to offend Stella. Though it was the truth. Stella was younger, but Dorothy was prettier.
Do you need anything, dear?
Stella asked Dot as she stood and bunched her blood pressure cuff under her arm. Dot shook her head, and Stella was gone. Dorothy chuckled after Stella left.
You'd think she would have enjoyed that. Not everyone has a doppelganger.
To gauge Dot's pain, one of the nurses suggested Dot grade her days, with A as perfectly healthy days and F as times where she felt close to death's door. Dot rated a lot of her days at the hospital a C-minus, sometimes even a D. On those days, the corners of the room warped into dragons and yetis. Her scalp itched tremendously, and every time she grappled for it, a clump of hair fell out. Dot's port, a gaping hole in her chest that fed medication straight to a vein, ached, and it became infected several times. The worst days were when she had seizures, because just before one started, she would feel the most nauseated she ever had in her life, and her vision would flip inward on itself, and she'd lose control of her limbs. She'd slip somewhere deep inside her body then. She witnessed everything, could see everything, but had no way of controlling what her body was doing. When she came out of it, her headaches were excruciating. Her skin felt like it was on fire. One time, the seizure was so violent that she almost bit through her tongue, and she had to have a giant bandage wrapped around the muscle for 4 days, lest she'd get another infection. She was so prone to infections. Bacteria adored her. The only thing that got her through any of it was her aunt's presence. If Dot needed Dorothy to sit by her side all night, Dorothy would. If Dot needed her to shove her finger into Dot's mouth during a seizure so she'd bite Dorothy's skin straight down to the bone instead of her own tongue, she would. And did, having the indentations to prove it. Every day, Dorothy came into Dot's room with fat medical books she'd purchased from the UCLA Medical School bookstore, researching unusual brain, lymph, blood, metabolic, and autoimmune diseases that could be making Dot seize. She demanded private audiences with Dot's doctors, and had even procured Dr. Coder's home phone number. She cornered her nurses in the hall and asked for the real scoop, in case Dot's doctors were mincing words. One time, Dot saw her sneak into an unattended nurse's station and fiddle with the computer.
What were you looking for?
Dot asked, after Dorothy had scurried away, just as a nurse came around the corner.
Notes in your file, of course, Dorothy whispered. Just in case there's anything I can look up. It's possible these doctors don't read all of the journals, you know. I'm filling in the gaps.
She sat by Dot's side for hours, reading her books, watching Dot's favorite programs on TV, making up stories. They fantasized about the food Dot would eat once she was out of here and able to eat a normal diet again. The hospital was keeping her on a very restrictive food regimen, thinking perhaps she had developed a bizarre allergy. She pointed to a restaurant called M&F Chop House across the street.
We'll go there for burgers. I hear they make delicious ones.
Dot studied the restaurant out the window. It had golden light seeping from its core. The bar was full. A TV in the corner played the news. A group at a table in the front talked animatedly.
Maybe I'll just live there, Dot mused.
A week before, her mother had announced she was going to marry the man she was dating, a man Dot barely knew, and who had a child Dot had never met.
Where would you sleep? Dorothy asked.
On a banquette?
No, in the room where they chop up the meat.
Dot had an unusual affinity for the smell of blood.
Dorothy chuckled.
You have quite the imagination.
And every night, I could dine with interesting people. Fortune tellers, witches, elves.
Elves? Who else?
It became a riff. Every day, they added to the tale of Dot at the Chop House. Dot would find a secret cave in the basement filled with crystals and stalagmites and gold doubloons. A dumbwaiter that led to a portal back to Gothic England, and she'd befriend Jack the Ripper. Dot of the Chop House had quite a few pets, but her favorites were her dog, Co, and her bat, Tristan. Tristan had the power of speech, but he could only recite sonnets. Dorothy was impressed that such a little girl knew what a sonnet was. For I have sworn thee fair, and though thee bright, who art as black as hell, as dark as night. Dot recited gleefully.
A genius, Dorothy proclaimed.
Your aunt's quite the firecracker, isn't she? Dr. Coder said one day, popping into Dot's room unannounced when Dorothy had taken a coffee break. Dot looked into the doctor's wet, Hershey-kiss-colored eyes. She had a bit of an Anna Nicole Smith thing going, with the blonde hair and huge boobs, but her glasses softened that, rendering her wise-ish. Yes, Dot answered proudly. Did you know she was once a model, and she got through half of medical school, in Tunisia, while she was taking a break from the CIA? Dr. Coder's smile wavered a little. Well, yes, but she's not a doctor here. Dot frowned. I know. Dr. Coder leaned a little closer. If you ever need some time alone, if it ever seems like too much, just tell us. If what is too much? Well, sometimes family can be a little suffocating, and it must be hard not being around kids your own age. You should check out our hangout area. We have a Miss Pac-Man machine. Dot was confused. Maybe Dr. Coder didn't like the Halloween decorations Dorothy had brought in. Doll parts popping out of coffins, decapitated bats, rotted eyeballs and cauldrons. Maybe they didn't like how Dorothy flirted with male specialists. Maybe they didn't like the time she brought that bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and drank it in Dot's room. But it wasn't like she'd given Dot any. And really, if the doctor should be mad at anyone, it should be Dot's mother. She barely showed up anymore. She just thrust all the responsibility on Dorothy while she attended office birthday parties and ate chocolate cake. Meanwhile, Dorothy helped Dot around the clock. Sometimes, Dorothy would come into Dot's room and collapse exhaustedly in a chair, even nodding off for a few moments, jolting awake if Dot so much as coughed. She probably does need a rest, Dot said. She's trying so hard. Dorothy swept in not 15 minutes later, wearing a Chanel suit and the Hermes scarf printed with prowling leopards, Dot's favorite. Did you see Dr. Coder in the hall? Dot asked. She said you might want to rest from here. You could go back to the Magnolia. I know how much you miss their eggs Benedict. Dorothy paused from unraveling her scarf from her neck.
Why would she say I need a rest?
Well, I might have hinted that you were tired.
What else did you say about me?
I don't know, Dot said cautiously. Her aunt's voice had grown so loud and shrill. Nothing, really.
Dorothy stomped around Dot's little room. Jesus, those jealous assholes. One of them gets an idea in her head, and it just infects everyone else. And meanwhile, it's you who suffers.
My baby.
Then she whirled away from the window. You don't really agree, do you? You don't want me gone.
Of course not.
Dot had no idea what her aunt was talking about. Dorothy collapsed to the chair and covered her face with her hands.
Oh, God. You do. You do.
This is how it starts. This is how I am abandoned.
Aunt Dorothy, Dot whispered. Please, Don't cry.
Everyone leaves me,
Dorothy said into her hands.
Thomas, your mother, my mother, my husband's, now you.
Don't say that. Her aunt kept her head down as she stumbled out of the room.
I can't be here right now. I can't look at you.
Wait! Dot scrambled out of her bed, getting tangled in all of the cords that fed into her body. I'm sorry. Whatever I did, I'm sorry.
She hobbled down the hall after Dorothy, dragging the IV pole behind her. But Dorothy was already through the exit's double doors. A nurse found Dot in the stairwell and walked her back to her room, saying that she couldn't leave the children's ward. Dot flopped back onto her horrid hospital bed and flipped through the TV channels. Everything on at that time of day was either terribly violent or a talk show featuring people yelling and sobbing. She turned the TV off and stared at the ceiling, listening to the soft murmurs of the intercom in the hall. After a while, she fell asleep, her scratchy, bleached pillow wet with tears. That evening, Dot had another seizure. All she remembered was her head flapping back against the pillow. The next thing she knew, she was strapped down to the bed, some sort of metal bite plate in her mouth. Dorothy stood over her, tears in her eyes. Dot croaked out a note of joy, but her head pounded, and she writhed in pain.
Honey, we have to get you out of this place, Dorothy said hurriedly.
What? Dot asked blearily, her tongue thick. Why?
This place is shit, that's why. I just found an article that this place has been written up for contamination 3 different times in the last 10 years. I bet you it's contaminated again. I bet you that's what's making you sick.
She started throwing Dot's stuffed animals into her duffel.
Let's go. I have a car waiting. We're going to a new place across town.
Now?
Dot tried to sit up.
Yes.
Dorothy extended her arm.
Do you think you can stand?
Dot pointed to the restraints around her. Dorothy nodded and undid them. Dot stood, but her head throbbed. She thought she might throw up. She didn't want to leave. She wanted to lie down.
I'm so tired, she murmured.
Let's go in the morning.
We can't wait for the morning.
Dorothy wrapped her arm around Dot's shoulders. You can sleep in the car.
Are the doctors okay with me going?
I signed all the papers to discharge you. It's our decision, not theirs. And anyway, screw them and their dirty hospital. I'm sorry I ever brought you here.
By now they were in the hall, which was eerily empty. Dot looked out the window. It was pitch dark outside. A wall clock in the break room said it was 3:15 a.m. She took another awkward step. The bottoms of her feet felt like pins and needles.
I wish I could say goodbye to Dr. Coder, Dot said. I liked her.
Dorothy waved her hand.
She's not getting any answers.
Can I call Mom?
After we go to the new place, Dorothy assured her. After we settle in.
Around a corner, she caught a glimpse of a swish of fabric and dark hair. Dot did a double take. Here was the other Dorothy, standing frozen next to a computer console. The real Dorothy straightened her spine and gripped Dot's arm. The other Dorothy, the nurse Stella, stared, unblinking, for a full, long 5 seconds. Then, raising her chin, she turned away without a word. Dot and Dorothy scrambled down the stairwell quickly, their shoes echoing against the metal risers. The walls of the new hospital's children's ward were painted a sunny yellow. Dot checked into a room and immediately fell asleep. When she awoke, her mother was standing in the hall, arguing with Dorothy.
You had no right to move her in the middle of the night. The other place was fine. Didn't you read that article I found?
You should have called me about this. Instead, you just did it.
I did it because I had to. It was her worst seizure yet. You weren't there. I was.
Dot opened one eye. Her mother had turned away. Her eyes had filled with tears. You deserve that, Dot thought. A new doctor introduced himself a half hour later. He said he would be taking care of Dot's treatment. Dorothy beamed brightly. Dr. Osuri, young, twitchy, with too many pens stuffed in his pocket, fiddled with the stethoscope around his neck.
It's lovely to meet you, Dot, he said, flipping through the medical file Dorothy had brought from St. Mother Maria's. We'll get to the bottom of what's happening to you.
Isn't that wonderful? Dorothy cried, arms clasped at her throat. What could Dot say? But yes. Eliza.
You've got to tell the police, I say to Desmond. I grab my phone and start to dial 911, then change my mind and look up the number for the Palm Springs PD on Google. Right now.
Okay, Desmond says, though he sounds uncertain. I manage to punch in the digits. The phone starts to ring, and I thrust it at him. He holds it outstretched like a writhing snake.
I'm not really versed in speaking with law enforcement, he says. What do you want me to say?
I snatch it back and listen as a receptionist answers in a peppy voice that I've reached Palm Springs PD and how may she direct my call.
I'm looking for Lance, I bark.
Lance who? The receptionist asks, all bubbles and sunshine. As if there's more than one Lance working at Palm Springs PD. But I don't remember his last name. Had he even told me his last name?
Lance, the forensic psychologist. Lance who visits patients in hospitals.
Please hold. They play Hall & Oates Maneater while I wait. Who chose that?
Can you describe the person you saw? I ask Desmond. Was it a girl? A guy?
I don't know.
He looks sheepish. I just remember a dark flash. Obsidian.
Why didn't you tell the cops this when they interviewed you? They did interview you, right?
Well, sure, they came when the ambulance came, and they asked me what happened. But this is when I presumed you'd fallen in. I didn't know to be on the lookout for a criminal, and they didn't ask if I'd seen anything.
I curl my hand into a fist. Of course, the cops didn't ask him. They'd probably already made up their minds I was drunk and suicidal.
You have to tell them what you saw, I urge again. I realize how I sound. I picture Desmond later tonight, having absinthe with Paul, his Comic-Con buddy who'd been with him poolside, talking about his crazy run-in with the paranoid, almost-drowned girl. But I'm also so relieved. There was a teeny, tiny part of me that did wonder if my family was right. Maybe I had jumped into the pool, just like all the other times. Maybe I was having a psychological break. Or maybe my tumor was back. Maybe I was sick again. But no, I had an assailant. So there. I practically want to sing it from the rooftops. I'm right. A voice breaks through Maneater.
Hello, you've reached the Palm Springs PD tip line. If you have information about a crime, please leave your tip at the beep.
My heart sinks. Then again, I suppose what I have is a tip. It's better than nothing. After the beep, I say what I have to say, then hang up. Well, hopefully they'll call, and then I'll conference you in if you're available. Or at least I'll give them your number.
Of course, Desmond says. I'll give you my address. I'm happy to help, very happy.
And then he looks at me. I stand to go, but he remains seated. His eyes soften. There's an expectant smile on his face, like he's waiting for the real party to start. Then something hits me. It's possible that I did something, poolside, when I woke up on the deck. I have a bad habit of having sex with strangers, despite how ridiculous I find them. I can almost picture it. Desmond pulled me out of the pool, revived me, and I took off all my clothes in gratitude. I grabbed his crotch.
Maybe we actually had sex there on the concrete before the EMTs came. And instead of being like every other guy and disappearing the moment the deed is done, Desmond actually has a conscience and has come over to see if I'm damaged and vulnerable. Or maybe he wants to have sex again. I weigh my options. He's a weird stranger who gets assassinated for fun. But he believes in me. And to be honest, his interest in me is flattering. I guess I don't have very high standards. I take a breath and move closer to him. All at once, his greenhouse scent is appealing, and my nipples go hard. The moment my lips actually make contact with his cheek, he shoots away. He says, fiddling with his vest, "Hello, nurse." I fumble too, jumping back so fast my calf slams against the table. Desmond is making a lot of noise with his keys. He checks his watch. Work to do. A lot of vendors to visit. So, let me walk you out. We get to the screen door at the same time and both reach for the handle, resulting in an awkward dance of him letting me go first, then me letting him go first, then both of us trying to stuff through the space together. We pass through my shiny kitchen, and I'm never so grateful for the pretty room in my life. It gives me credibility, sanity, even though if Desmond peeked in the pantry, he'd notice an unhealthy amount of Kraft macaroni and cheese, which I eat by the truckload, even though I'm not supposed to. We stop at the door, and I don't know what to do with my hands. Finally, I just stick out my palm for him to shake. Thanks for coming by. Thanks for saving me. Because what else do you say? The door shuts. I spin around and survey my quiet house. My living room is filled with odd antique trunks and armoires I purchased from an antiques dealer in Santa Cruz. The pale pink couch has a mysterious stain on it that might be blood. It was like that when I bought it. In the corner is a dusty RCA theremin from the 1920s. I've meant to take lessons, but I've never gotten around to it. All of a sudden, the hair on the back of my neck stands. Someone is watching me. I sense a flicker in the corner of my eye and whip around, certain I'm going to discover a presence there. The curtains flutter as if someone has just jumped through the open window. Or maybe it's just the breeze. Hello? I call out shakily. No answer. What if this isn't over? What if whoever tried to hurt me is still out there, hoping to hurt me again? I rake my fingers down my face. My fingernails knead harder and harder until I know I'm close to drawing blood. But it isn't satisfying enough. So I twist a lock of hair around my finger and pull hard. The pain is sharp, eye-numbing. I stifle a yelp. And then I run upstairs as fast as I can, eager for a closed door, eager for darkness, eager to get away from whatever this is. My bedroom is long like a bowling lane and almost as thin. On the walls are animal skulls and posters of Wednesday Addams, who was my childhood idol. On my bureau are vitamin bottles, vitamin powders, a healing stone given to me by a shaman I visited in the desert, an iPod loaded with meditation tapes that I try to use but don't really work, and the energy drawings I did with an art therapist that revealed my soul was a dark, twisted knot. I'm trying my hardest to prevent the tumor from invading my body again. But sometimes, I think the preventative shit is worse than the illness. I think I saw someone running away. I swallow hard. It's vindicating that Desmond has confirmed this, but it scares me that such violence actually exists. Who could have pushed me? I picture my mother's face swirling above me yesterday in the hospital, and Bill's, and Gabby's. Who alerted them to come? How had they arrived so quickly? Then I remember it hadn't been that fast. I'd been sleeping for quite a few hours before I spoke to them. But still, is it possible they'd already been in Palm Springs? But what am I presuming? That one of them pushed me? Why would they do that? Because I'm a drain on them? Because they're sick of my shenanigans? Because I'd done something to one of them. Something inside me rolls over with a ripple. Maybe. But why can't I remember what that is? I sap on Gabby again. It's not as though we're close. After Bill made the introductions the first time she and I met, I went into the kitchen and she followed. I didn't ask her to follow, nor did I really want her there. Gabby said quietly once we were alone. I heard your dad died. So did my mom. I snorted, like I was going to have that conversation. Straightening my spine, I pulled out a big bottle of vodka from the freezer. My fingers burned with cold as I unscrewed the cap, and I poured myself a tall glass. Want some? Gabby's eyes widened. No way. I tipped the glass to my lips like I was a pro. I'd never had vodka before, but I felt like I needed to establish myself with this girl early on so she knew the pecking order. I took the tiniest sip and tried not to wince. I watched Gabby stare at me in horror.
Maybe you shouldn't do that, she whispered.
Then my mother and Bill walked in. My mother immediately saw the bottle on the counter. What's that? Neither of us answered. Gabby pushed her glasses up her nose. Who got that out? My mother said, staring at me. Gabby cleared her throat.
I did. I just wanted to try it.
Bill looked appalled. You? Oh, please. My mother rolled her eyes. It was clearly Eliza.
No.
Gabby's voice was stronger now.
It was me.
I don't know why she took the blame. I wanted to believe it was because I was so crazy and unpredictable that she thought it would be better just to defuse my actions and not make waves. But I wasn't entirely sure. I needed to be sure. I needed her to fear me. Why I needed that so badly is something I can't remember now, but I distinctly wrote about it in my journal. I don't need her feeling sorry for me. She doesn't know what I can do. Through the years, I proved to Gabby what I could do. I locked her in a closet and stood outside reading facts about body decomposition from a criminology textbook. I put preserved animals I found at pawn shops on her pillow at night. I was a fan of fake plastic spiders in cereal bowls, a rubber dismembered hand in her backpack, and once, shoving the old child-sized coffin I kept in my room into the front entrance of the house and squeezing myself into it just before she walked through the door. Gabby had fainted when she saw me, just crumpled bonelessly to the floor, thwacking her head on the door jamb. She'd needed stitches on her eyebrow, and yet, when Bill asked Gabby what had happened, she said she'd tripped. She never told on me for anything I did to her. She just absorbed all of it silently, stoically, pretending like it never happened. Why didn't she ever fight back? I heard her arguing with her friends on the phone. I hacked her email and uncovered quite a few heated debates on a Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince fanfiction message board. She lost her shit when a girl at school called her a fuckface. I called her far worse. Was she doing it because she'd figured out not reacting was the path to victory? Or was she storing up each and every incident, cataloging it carefully and referring to it often, slowly growing angrier and angrier, and then downright vengeful? Was she a volcano ready to blow? Do you really think someone would want to hurt you? Lance had asked. Gabby might have wanted to, but I just couldn't imagine Gabby doing such a thing. She didn't have the chutzpah. I open my eyes and look around. The light seems different in my room. For a moment, I've forgotten my train of thought. I've had a stroke, I think frantically. But the clock says it's only a few minutes later, and all of my limbs work. I reach for my cell phone, but I've received no new calls. I'm about to put the phone down when I hit the button for my saved photo gallery. There's a video I don't remember recording first in line in the preview window. I press play. The camera pans over the hospital room I've just left. First the corner with the sink, then those ugly paisley drapes, then a slice of window, the view of the parking lot. I hear a small sigh. The camera shifts, then slowly shows my body on the hospital bed. My arm, my fingers, my chin. My eyes are closed.
I look at the video's timestamp. 10:09 p.m., yesterday night. The angle is such that I could have held the phone outstretched, selfie style, but there was no way I'd taken it. I'd only found out my phone was in my room this morning.